Have you ever asked yourself why? Well, now you can ask Andy why. News, views and conspiracy theories.
Absolutely. On Beatroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And tonight's show is going to be about zombies and the undead. It's kind of a bit of a refresh of a show I did before. But with some more information, some brighter stuff and stuff like this, going through some of the creatures of the undead, whether they be corporeal or incorporeal, corporeal, whatever. And I will explain what that is in a bit. And then a very interesting thing, which the US government have done on about zombies. So that will be towards the end of the show, maybe the last half an hour. I'm also going to talk a little bit about something the boss mentioned to me, if I can get it up on my phone. Hopefully I can. Which is talking about the potential. There was a drug which is known as the zombie drug. And it's an African drug, and we'll talk about that street drug, right? And I'll just kind of wing that from my phone and we'll see where that goes. Or maybe I can bring it up on the computer here. But there we go. Don't want to press too many buttons and mess something up. Next week, my show is going to be the best of British banking. Banking, that's right. Which is going to talk about some of the different things that have happened over time. And show how there's a familiar feel to it psychically, how we go through these things, and basically how the banks control the world, actually. They control the governments, they control everything. Because what they seek to do is where the money goes, and where the money goes is what the government has to support, because the government relies on the financial industry for money, basically. Not taxes, not stuff like that. I thought you kind of wondered about that. Because, of course, they have to bank it. They have to do it through the financial services. But anyway, we'll be talking about all of that. So that's next week. So let's make a start on zombies and the undead. Now, you could say there's a generic term for the undead, which would be revenants. According to dictionary.com, that's a person who returns as a spirit after death. So there's two definitions there. A person who returns, or a person who returns as a spirit after death. And according to Wiki, the undead may be incorporeal, like ghosts, or corporeal, like vampires and zombies. So you get the idea that they're either a spirity type of creature, or they're a solid flesh, well, physical creature, but still dead, still undead. All right, so let's start by talking about incorporeal spirits. So those are the ones that are spirits, and not the corporeal side. So, okay, you get that. So, all right, so let's start with one called the Banshee. Now, according to CelticWeddingRings.com, a Banshee is said to be a fairy in Irish legend. It's very, very Irish, this. And her scream is believed to be an omen of death. The scream is also called Cawin, which I think I pronounce correctly, which means keening. It is a warning that there will be an imminent death in the family. And as Irish families blended over time, it is said that each family has its own banshee. And they could appear in various different forms. And some of them are kind of okay, except for the scream, right? But some of them not so much. Here we go. A beautiful woman wearing a shroud. A pale woman in a white dress with long red hair. Very Irish, that. A woman with a long silver dress and silver hair. A headless woman carrying a bowl of blood that is naked from the waist up. That's pretty scary. An old woman with frightening red eyes, a green dress and long white hair. And of course, we associate red eyes with demons and devils and stuff like that. So that's not a good one. Or an old woman with a veil covering her face, dressed all in black with long grey hair. Okay. Now, historians have traced the first stories of the Banshee to the 8th century, the 8th century, so the 700s, which were based on a tradition where women sang a sorrowful song to lament someone's death. And of course, they would hire these people. They would hire women to come in because it was part of the, I guess, the process by which the spirit went to the other world. And so you would want someone there who was able to do this lamenting, this keening, whatever it is. So the women were known as keeners. And since they accepted alcohol as payment, they were said to be sinners and punished by being doomed to become banshees. Now, of course, you've got to know that religion's got in there somewhere, because why is somebody who drinks alcohol a sinner? It's only because somebody else has made a rule that said, oh, you can't drink alcohol because that's a sin. Or it might be that just women can't drink alcohol. But anyway, you get the idea of that. So the poor women who were hired to do these things, who then accepted alcohol, and maybe they sold it on, who knows, maybe they drank it themselves. But then they were punished because they were naughty because they drank alcohol, and they would become banshees themselves. Not much of a career path, that one. And according to the mythology of the Banshee, if spotted, she, the Banshee, will vanish in a cloud of mist, and this action creates a noise similar to that of a bird flapping its wings. So you imagine that you hear this keening, this screaming noise, and you come round a figure and you see one of those figures, a woman with a long silver dress, silver hair, who suddenly disappears and you hear the birds flapping. Okay. And I think as we go through this, just think about, is there any practical way this could happen? Because, of course, that could be a kind of a legend or mythology that's grown from somebody who heard this noise that sounded like keening, that was in fact a bird. And when they went to investigate it, a flock of birds flew away. Ah, okay. Because some of these are kind of like, well, you know, if there were such these terrible things, why did they stop? Why haven't we still got them now? Maybe they'd be in a zoo or something like that now. Or maybe they are. Maybe they're in some secret government establishment being investigated and experimented on to see if we can make a super soldier or something like that. But anyway, there we are. That was the Banshees. Now, of course, the legend says that Banshees don't actually cause the death, but they only serve as a warning to it. So if you're not hearing a Banshee, everything should be reasonably okay. All right. But the thing about spirits is could they be something else? Could they be something to do with dimensions? Could they do something to do with trapped earthbound energy? I mean, that we are in the world now of the woo-woo, I suppose, in a way. But because of progress we're making with quantum physics, and we keep going down further and further and finding nothing but energy, perhaps some of that stuff could be real. At least we got to have an open mind to it. Some of these other things, and we'll come on to the corporeal ones, maybe we've got a little less tolerance for those kind of things. So the next one's going to be a ghost or a phantom or a spectre ghost or something like that. And I've actually taken this from a show I did back in July 2018. And these things, ghost, phantom or spectre ghosts, are often seen as translucent. That's the clue. You can see through them. Vague or smoky in appearance. And this could be a logical, well, sort of fairly pseudological way of looking at it, is because the observer is observing, is perceiving the apparition as distinct from seeing it. So the differentiation between what I'm saying in there is you're not actually seeing it with your eyes. You're perceiving it with your mind, your body, yourself, whatever. You're feeling the energy of it rather than actually seeing an optical sort of presence. Now, a ghost could be a feeling. It could be a feeling perhaps of coldness, sadness, fear or dread. It could be seen directly or maybe as a shadow, a reflection. Some ghosts are called poltergeists. You've probably heard of those. And they're usually mischievous. They could be malevolent. They do have physical talent, so they can hide things. They can move things. They can even throw things. And I mean, how many times have you or me or whatever of us looked for something over and over and over again and just can't find it? And for example, you might have looked in a drawer. So you go around the house, you're looking for, I don't know, your keys. So you go around the house looking for your keys, you look in the drawer where you normally keep it, and then you go around the house and everything, you look once more in that drawer, and then you go around the house again like this. You say, I just can't find it. I always put it in this drawer. And you open the drawer again, and there's the keys. Have you ever had that happen to you? I know I certainly have, many times. And you're thinking, I looked in that drawer. I absolutely looked in that drawer. I checked it. Put my hand right into the back of the drawer, felt around, moved the stuff around. Who knows? Okay. So ghosts can be related to time and space. So a historical ghost might be seen in the dress of the historical period and in a significant location. You've heard of the white lady, the grey lady. There are lots of the hooded monk. All these kind of things are British ghosts, actually. And they're all related to a specific castle or a monastery or a pub or something like that, right? You might even see them in the place of their execution. And I've always wondered if at the time of execution, because there's such a massive amount of emotion and energy there, is there something there that could actually trap some kind of essence of a person there? Just a thought. And I mean, a ghost can appear routinely at the same place, e.g. in a room, corridor, staircase, in a particular building. And, you know, I have seen a ghost once, full-bodied apparition, as they say, and I wondered if that ghost was a regular visitor. I mean, you've got to say, oh, well, you just imagined it. Oh, well, it must have been the trick of the sunlight, blah, blah, blah. Sure as heck didn't look like it to me. But there we are. I mean, because we're trained to immediately reach for a more logical kind of almost scientific explanation, we might be ignoring the obvious. So the location of a ghost sighting may give a clue to the nature of its demise. Okay, so somebody in a battlements of a castle, maybe somebody who's killed in a battle or something, or actually jumped off the battlements and fell to their death. Now, one theory, and of course, you've often heard of ghosts can actually walk through walls and things like this. And I did hear one theory about this, and that theory was that in their time, because they're historical ghosts now, in their time, those walls weren't actually there. So, for example, as often happens, you build a church on an ancient site, a pagan site. That used to happen a lot. And then you see a ghost walking through the wall of the church. Well, actually, when that ghost or that creature actually died, there wasn't a church there. So it's not walking through a wall. It's walking through nothing, which was what was there when it was back in time in history, if you get where I'm going with that. Okay. So in actual fact, well, another theory is that ghosts are purely energetic beings. And being energetic, and everything is energetic, right? So the walls are energetic. They just appear solid to us because of our kind of frequency level or whatever we're at in that quantum, and we don't want to get into this, but that quantum level. If you're an energy creature, then maybe you can walk through a wall because it is energy, you are energy, and therefore you can kind of pass through just a transfer of energy from one field to another. I don't know. Those kind of things. So another iconic creature of the incorporeal spirits would be the Grim Reaper. Oh, yeah, that's a big one that appears in many, many places. Now, according to mythology.net, the Reaper has a long black cloak. The cloak wraps all the way around the spectre's body, shrouds his face from a deep hood. It is usually loose and tattered, so the bits of black flutter in the wind as the Reaper moves. That's a nice description, right? In his hand, the Reaper carries a scythe, which, if you didn't know, is a long pole with a curved blade fixed to the top. The scythe is traditionally used to harvest crops at the end of fall, autumn, right? But in the reaper's case, it is used to harvest souls at the end of their life. Now, the spectre may also carry an hourglass, which he uses to measure the amount of time left in life. Finally, he may travel on the back of a ghostly white horse or in a chariot pulled by white horses. And one of the biggest kind of historical pictures you get, or a scenario that you could imagine, something like the Grim Reaper, is back in the medieval times and in the plague times, where the streets were littered with corpses. And you could imagine this black-robed with the scythe coming down to collect the souls of the dead there. It's kind of spooky, isn't it? Lovely stuff, lovely stuff. But, hey, he's not seen around much these days, because with 7.5 billion people in the world, he'd be pretty busy, wouldn't he? Maybe there's one in each country, who knows? Now, there's another one called the Shadow Person. And this is from pararational.com. And these are human-shaped shadow people. There's actually different categories, so we'll go through them all. Human-shaped shadow people. And these make up the bulk of the shadow people sightings and include the typical cloaked figure and shadow people wearing hats, because one of the legends in the United States is Hat Man. It's this dark figure wearing a hat. They often see it in a silhouette. No features, but they can just see there is this hat on the top of the head. And they can come in a variety of combinations. Obviously, what these shadow people are, well, nobody knows. It's pure speculation right now. The persistent shadow of the lurking variety don't generally seem to be purely evil in intent. They just seem more interested in us, being around us, watching us, and I guess feeding off our energy. Others are simply negative manifestations of spirits. Almost universally, though, they are a sign of something negative. It's not a good thing to see one of these. And I got to say, a lot of people, including myself, would say that they often go into a room and feel as if something has left it. In my case, I've often gone in a room and seen a sort of a black shadow leave the room. Because you know that with your vision, you have a focal point in the middle. And it's almost as if it's a different definition, if you like. So the middle 10%, 15% of your vision, when you're looking straight ahead, the middle bit, is a HD, high definition, right? But the outsides are kind of somewhat less distinct. You could see movement, because that's what it's for, because so that you can turn your focal point to that position to see exactly what it is, bring your full power of your vision organ onto that. But really, it's just there so that you have some observation of what is in your peripheral vision, as it's called. Well, you'll often see a black shape or something move in that peripheral vision, and then when you turn to look at it, it's gone. Question is that real? Is it imagination? When you get up to my age, you get things called floaters in your eye, which are little threads of protein, which are little black things that you can sometimes see in certain lights. Again, who knows? But there do seem to be a lot. I know when I was younger, I used to see a ton of these things, and I had to actually start to ignore it and blank it from my mind, because it was very distracting. I mean, when you're talking to somebody, you look him in the eye and suddenly your eyes go off to the side to look at something that isn't there. It can be quite disturbing for the person you're talking to. Anyway, whatever. So we're talking about those were human shadow-shaped shadow people. There are also these ones called black mass shadow people, and that might be the idea of a dark shape leaving a room or something. These are less human in form, but still of that general size, and the black mass type of shadow people give the impression of being a human figure, but more fuzzy and blurred. So not so distinct as the man, the dark man in the hat, the tall man, all those legends or mythologies or whatever they are, scary bedtime stories, whatever they are. They're a little bit less distinct. And yeah, that's what they are. They can change shape when they, you know, I presume when they want. They can form more of a cloud. But the impression is always there is some kind of an entity that is there. Now, some people assert that many of these black mass shadow people are former negative spirits that have begun growing in power and are losing their human identity. So I guess the idea is somehow they've got trapped in between the dimensions of what we would call life and death. And somehow a piece of a person or a piece of their character, their identity, their ego has split off somehow and has retained. And it has the ability to absorb energy, good energy or bad energy. And if it absorbs bad energy, then it becomes much more of this kind of black mass shadow person, absorbing more and more negative emotions, and their sense of being a human being just fades away. So they become distorted, and in the end, they become a form of the following type of shadow people, which are those that are demonic. Now, demonic's a funny old thing, because demonic tends to be religious, right? I mean, people would say, oh, the demon, the devil, and all this kind of thing, but the devil was almost a creation of the church, because, let's be honest, if we believe that there were, it was God and there was Lucifer, Prince of Light, chief of the angels, and then he had a bit of a dust up with God. That's all he did wrong. He wasn't evil or anything. He just didn't agree with God's policies. How many of us would be guilty of that, right? Not necessarily God's policies, but say at where you work or where you're at home or whatever, right? And then everything that's nasty gets thrown at Lucifer. Now, I'm not saying Lucifer's good, because I don't really believe any of it. But the fact is that that's what Lucifer did. And then the church said, oh, yeah, he's evil, he's Satan, he's a demon, he's this, he's that, he's this, he's that. However, sometimes there is a idea, a concept, a feeling, an emotion that something could be evil. And evil is not an emotion. It really is a state, like good and evil. Whether that's been created by thousands of years of religious teaching and stuff like this, or whether it is actually something. But that's what we're going to talk about, demonic. The demonic shadow people. And generally speaking, they have red eyes. Now, these are definitely, according to some sources, these are definitely the most dangerous of the types of shadow people. Demonic shadows, and they should be avoided at all costs. Now, among shadow people, there are the ones of the types you can sometimes see the eyes of. Many accounts of them talk of glowing red eyes, which is a particularly bad sign. And I know this, I can't think what it's called now, but it's where people wake up and they're frozen in their bed and they have this concept of some dark thing crawling up them with bright, shining red eyes. Sleep paralysis is waking up and you can't move. And night terrors, that's what they're called, right? Scary, scary, whether it's real or not, whether it's inside somebody's head or actually some kind of a real or spiritual thing. Awfully scary. Feel very sad for people, sorry for people that have those kind of issues. So the demonic forms could vary wildly. I've just mentioned one. They usually retain a humanoid shape, but could often be exaggerated in height, have wings or horns. You see, now we're back in the churchy thing. Elongated fingers. They do not give the impression of being a normal ghost or a sentient entity. Because a ghost would kind of be some part of a person, their character, their ego, as I mentioned before. So they'd be like they were, the grey lady, the white lady, the hooded monk, whatever. These are, because of their darkness, their kind of evilness, they don't give that same idea that this is a normal ghost. And they're normally tied to one location. So, again, that might be the idea of a historical ghost. Now, there are other types, which could be one of the more common is the old hag. And the old hag appears in so many different legends. Of course, you've seen it in Disney. And what was it? Snow White, the beautiful queen, was able to turn herself into an old hag so she could go and give the apple to Snow White, whatever. And that's, of course, an old fairy tale. So that's come out of mythology and legend. Other less common reports are of shadow people that are non-human but seem more alien than demonic in nature. And I'm not sure if that's because we're in a more modern age now. But alien doesn't necessarily mean little green men with big eyes. Could be all kinds of different things. Certainly alien from the life forms that we know. And of course, you could have other shadow entities, things like the black dog, which actually is in quite a few legends of places where this evil hound, you hear its feet padding. If you run, it runs after you, that sort of thing. Pretty scary stuff, right?
Andy Way on Beatroot Radio.
That's Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley, and we are talking about zombies and the undead. So the next one we're going to look at now is the Wraith. Now, it's an odd one, the Wraith, because it's hard to know exactly what it is. But anyway, from Wiktionary, in 1513, it certainly appeared in a Middle Scots translation of the Aeneid. Three quotes. Nor yet no vain wraiths nor quaint ghosts constrain thy chariot to go backwards. Another one. Such as that they say in diverse places, the wraiths walk of ghosts that are dead. And the third one. Thither went this wraith or shade of e'en that seemed all abase fast to flee. So, obviously the idea of a wraith was around. And because you can hear it mixed up with ghosts in there, so maybe it's some kind of ghost. Now, according to mythology.net, wraiths are supposed to be creatures that are created when something goes wrong in spell casting. Often the result of a witch or wizard who tried unsuccessfully to extend the years of their lifespan or tried to manipulate time in some other form. So that's making the assumption that spell casting, witchcraft, wizardry actually works. Okay. So that's where that comes from. So what has happened, because they've tried to manipulate time or something like that, they're now immortal beings with incredible power. So they're between the realms, if you like. But their souls have gone. So they're condemned never to reach the spirit realm. So we're back to this idea of reaching the spirit realm, going to heaven kind of thing. And the spirit realm is often thought to be something similar to heaven. And in most cultures, and is considered to be an afterlife. So wraiths are denied this privilege and forced to wander between dimensions for eternity. But because they're between dimensions, they have a foot in both the spiritual and the physical. That makes them pretty powerful. Now, wraiths can only feel devastating emotions like hatred or despair. They are a type of ghost, but can also be considered a type of demon because of this hatred and despair. There are instances that wraiths can be considered good. There's a specific type of wraith, if you want to look it up, known as a voror, V-O-R-O-R, voror. But most wraiths are inherently evil. Okay, so they're evil creatures that seek out to steal the souls of others. Now, I'd have thought The reason they want to steal the souls for others is to make them complete so that they could then move on into the next realm of existence, whatever that is. But according to this definition from mythologynet.net, it says within a single touch, the wraith is able to drain the life out of a person and steal their soul. And whenever they steal the soul of that person, the victim is cursed to wander with them for eternity, unless the wraith is killed. Well, how can you kill a thing that's kind of in-betweeny, right? Now, wraiths are powerful creatures and are therefore an extremely difficult foe to overcome. We're going to need magic, right? So they can only be defeated by a holy presence. So this is a holy object or something, or maybe calling down an angel or something like this. Magic, right? Or with some kind of a magical weapon, so an enchanted weapon. Being pure evil, they are not able to understand holiness of any kind, so that's religious, and will either be forced to retreat or destroyed by the opposing force. Right. Okay, well, that's what it is. So now, everything we've talked about so far have been ghosts and wraiths and things like that have been incorporeal. Incorporeal. So let's talk about corporeal ones. And the difference being is that one is a spirit, is an energy, is a kind of a non-physical presence. And some of them actually are able to do physical things, like a poltergeist, right? What we're going to talk now is about living corpses, which would be more like the corporeal. In other words, they are physical. So living corpses, they're mythical, and this is from mythicalcreaturesandbeasts.com. And there's this creature called a Draugr. And that's D-R-A-U-G-R, Draugr. And they're the ghosts of dead Vikings, and they dwell in their graves. They possess superhuman strength and can increase their size at will. They appear from the graves as wisps of smoke and carry the strong stench of decaying flesh. They slay their victims in many ways, including crushing them while in their gigantic form. So when they increase in size, they also increase in weight, and they can squidge somebody underneath them. These monsters enjoy devouring flesh and drinking the blood of their unfortunate victims. Animals that choose to scavenge near any graves occupied by Draugr were said to be driven mad by the control and power of these evil mythical creatures. These entities were said to often come back even after being defeated. So what do you do to defeat one of these things? Well, you can cut off their heads, you can burn the bodies, and then take the ashes from that burning and throw them in the sea. And those were some of the methods used to mutilate the bodies after defeat. Being absolutely sure these menacing evil spirits were dead and gone was imperative. Now, to prevent the return, and obviously, in modern day times, how many dead Vikings, Draugrs, do we see around the streets these days? Not many, right? Because to prevent their return, the dead Vikings, scissors are placed on their chests, along with bits of twig hidden in their clothing. And there must be some kind of magical property or something that makes that mean that they stay in their graves. What they also do is their big toes are tied together and needles driven through their feet. Remember, they're dead, because that sounds really painful, but they're dead. And needles are driven through their feet to keep them from walking again once they are dead. All right. So you get that. So, and you would often find, particularly in Europe and so on, that they would do things to corpses to make sure they couldn't come back. I know it's somewhere near Venice, actually. There was a place near there, and I think I talked about that on my show about vampires. And they used to put bricks into the mouths of the corpses to prevent them using their jaws, because they were afraid they'd come back as vampires. You've seen the movies, of course, where they behead the vampire or they drive a stake through its heart. So that's the kind of thing, is messing with the body to prevent it coming back from the dead. Now, a ghoul. Well, according to Wiki, a ghoul is a demon or monster originating in pre-Islamic Arabian religion, associated with graveyards and consuming human flesh. And I think that might well be mostly dead human flesh, all right? But of course, a ghoul is a great one. Damn doorbell again. A ghoul is a good one for modern fiction. And the term has often been used for a certain kind of undead monster. So, from sciencehowstuffworks.com, by extension, the word ghoul is also used in a derogatory sense to refer for a person who delights in the macabre or whose profession is linked directly to death, such as a grave digger or grave robber. Now, I'd have to stick up for the grave diggers there. Grave diggers do a fairly unpleasant job, I'd say. And they have to be, because you'll see grave diggers at funerals. So they have to be of a certain ilk. They have to be very solemn and serious and take things seriously. And I don't think you should ever call them a ghoul just because they have a job which is helping to deal with those pesky dead bodies, right? I mean, you know, it happens. It's got to be done. So really, I think that's a bit of a bad thing to say about gravediggers, because otherwise you have to say a thing about doctors, oncologists, right? Their outcomes are pretty low, so they're dealing with death a lot. You wouldn't call them a ghoul. So anyway, but a grave robber, that's a different thing, right? That's a ghoul. That's a ghoul right there. Now, while some souls define ghouls as evil spirits rather than undead creatures, most accounts give them physical bodies. They're generally slumped, and this is more the Arabian type of one, right, than a grave robber. They're generally slumped, bipedal humanoids, although they often scramble and crawl on all fours due to their stealthy nature and tendency to occupy cramped tunnels and tombs. Their bodies may appear emaciated and dog-like. But particularly gluttonous or powerful ghouls may grow quite fat on indecent delicacies. In other words, dead flesh. Their skin may be pale or grey, and the flesh itself may appear hairless, rubbery, or even scaly, although many Middle Eastern legends depict them as hairy ogres. Exact facial features seem to differ as well, from nearly human to bestial and canine. Okay, here's an interesting one. The Jiangshi. Jiangshi. Chinese, obviously. And it's known as a hopping zombie. It's a type of reanimated corpse in Chinese legends and folklore. It is typically depicted as a stiff corpse dressed in official garments from the Qing dynasty. And it moves around by hopping, with its arms outstretched. And you'll get the connection, because it sounds very silly, doesn't it? But you'll get the idea in a minute when I explain. It rests in a coffin or hides in dark places such as caves. Now, Jiangshis can be created by the use of supernatural arts to resurrect the dead. There's always magic, right? Spirit possession of a dead body. So a spirit moves into a body that's been vacated. A corpse absorbs sufficient yang qi to return to life. So you know the oriental ideas of yin and yang. And qi is universal life force. So if it were possible to get that universal life force into a corpse, it might reanimate it. Now here's an explanation which is similar to that, uses slightly different words. A person's body is governed by three huns and seven poes. What does that mean? Well, a Qing dynasty scholar, Yuan Mai, wrote in his book Zi Bu Yu that a person's hun is good, but his po is evil. His hun is intelligent, but his po is not so good. The hun leaves the body after death, but his po remains, and therefore it takes control of the body, so the dead person becomes a yang shi. Another way it could be created is by a dead person who's not buried even after a funeral's been held. The corpse comes to life after he is struck by a bolt of lightning, or when a pregnant cat, or a black cat in some tales, leaps across the coffin. Always those problems with black cats crossing your path, even when you're dead. Now, when a person's soul, is another way, when a person's soul fails to leave the deceased's body due to improper death, suicide, or just wanting to cause trouble. Okay? One more. A person injured by a yangshi is infected with the yangshi virus and gradually changes into a yangshi over time. That's a little bit like the zombie thing or the vampire thing, isn't it? Or the werewolf thing, in fact. Now, this is what explains the hopping zombies. The concept of a yangshi may have been created by the practice of returning corpses of persons home who have died a long distance away. And this was normal. This was something you would do. And you can kind of understand it. Somebody's died, you want them taken to their place of home, where they were born, where their village is, whatever like this, so that they can be buried in their local area. But to transport the corpses, what a couple of entrepreneurial people would do, and they, okay, and this is common, is they would get a bunch of these corpses, so let's say they've got to travel a distance, 50 miles or something like this, or 20 miles, whatever, right? They would tie the corpses to a bamboo pole, which they would carry on their shoulders between them, right? But the corpses would be tied to the pole standing up, right? Get the picture? So let's say two people, because corpses get lighter as they putrefy, right, and the liquid leaves them, so they might be able to transfer those corpses, say four of them, right? So imagine what you would see when you saw two guys walking along with a pole in between them, these four corpses on there, and of course the bamboo pole would flex, so it would look like the corpses were hopping upside up and down, right? And they reckon that's how they got the idea of these hopping zombies. This is sort of a more slightly logical, if not gruesome, way of describing how that might happen. Where you get the idea, don't ya?
Andy Way on Beatroot Radio.
Community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And we're talking about zombies and the undead. And just a reminder, the zombies will come towards the end of the show. Last half an hour, I should think. Very, very, very interesting. A little bit of conspiracy theory in there as well, which is delicious, of course. And don't forget, this show will be packed on down to a podcast and put onto my website probably tomorrow, if not soon. And you can access it 7x24. So if you've got a buddy or somebody like that who hasn't had a listen to it and might be interested in learning something more about zombies and the undead, then they can check that out at www.drandyyates.com. That's www.drandyyates.com. Check it out. And I might get a chance to do a little download or a thought load or whatever. Probably on the zombie bit, which you'll be hearing later, on YouTube, on the Incongruous channel. That's my channel, the Incongruous channel. And you might find that interesting too, just to get a slightly different perspective as I deal with that specifically. But let's carry on with a lich. Lich, yes. And this is according to Wiki. Now, a lich, it's something that really kind of comes from fantasy fiction. I mean, it is in Old English, a lich, and it means a corpse. A lich is a corpse, but in fantasy fiction, it's become an undead creature. Similar to a wraith, but in physical form, such a creature is the result of a transformation as a powerful magician skilled in necromancy or a king striving for eternal life, using spells or rituals to bind his intellect to a soul or to his amulet or charm, and thereby achieving a form of immortality. Okay, so A lich may be a purposeful thing because they've got their soul in the amulet and therefore they can continue to exist as an immortal form of lich. You get that. Liches are depicted as being clearly cadaverous, bodies desiccated or completely skeletal, because the soul, the life part of them, is actually there in that amulet or charm. Liches are also depicted as holding power over hordes of lesser undead creatures, using them as soldiers and servants. Now, unlike zombies, which are often depicted as mindless, a lich is sapient, retaining independent thought, and is as intelligent as it was prior to its transformation. There you go. Okay, so it's quite a different type of creature, that one. Scary, because it's still intelligent. Now, one that we've all heard of is a mummy, but actually a mummy monster, which is slightly different, right? Because a mummy is just a dry thing covered in bandages that you see in a museum. But a mummy monster, according to fandom.com, is a pretty grim thing. Because a mummy, as you know, is a human or animal corpse that's been preserved through embalming and buried in a careful and respectful manner. And the idea is it's embalmed and buried in that way so that it can come back to life at some point. Now, the practice of intentional mummification began in ancient Egypt and was performed to honour deceased pharaohs and their servants. But, of course, mummies have often been used in horror fiction, depicted as undead creatures seeking revenge against those who defiled their tombs. And mummies have often been described as wielding supernatural powers, and, of course, you've seen the movies where that's shown. And the exact nature of these powers varies for mediums, that is the genre in which they're played, but such abilities include immunity to all forms of attack, and because they're dead already, draining the life force of mortals, and to more outlandish and over-the-top feats, such as control of the weather, or even swarms of insects, which have been in more modern movies that we've seen, right? But here's kind of where all that lot came from. And this is according to ancient.eu, Joshua J. Clark, May 2017. And he said, or he reported that, Howard Carter's 1922 discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun was worldwide news. But following fast on it, the story of the mummy's curse, also known as the Curse of the Pharaoh, became even more popular and continues to be so in the present day. Now, Carter, Howard Carter, right, the archaeologist, had located the tomb in early November 1922, but needed to wait until his sponsor and financial backer, Lord Carnarvon, arrived for England to open it. The tomb was finally opened by Carter in the presence of Carnarvon and his daughter, Lady Evelyn, on 26 November 1922. And within a month, the site was attracting visitors and press from all around the world and was already on itineraries for high-priced tours of Egypt. So Lord Carnarvon died in Cairo, 5th of April 1923, less than 6 months after the tomb was opened, and that meant the mummy's curse was born. Now, what you've got to know is the newspapers at the time were just going crazy over this stuff because it was brilliant news. It was all exotic and too far away to imagine, fantastic ideas. But because of all this press and everything like this, I think Carter or Lord Carnarvon or whatever got fed up with it and sold the exclusive rights, I think, to the Times for a sum of money too, because they also needed not only to have carried out the excavation, they now needed to preserve and remove, steal what they could from the Egyptians, whatever. Actually didn't, because all the Tutankhamun stuff is actually in the Cairo Museum. I've seen it. But it's that was the idea. Anyway, they needed more money, so they sold the rights for all the sort of interviews and reporting and so on and so on, I think to the Times. Times, the British newspaper, right? So all the other press were locked out of this. So they would jump on any rumour they heard, because as the Times was putting out the more scientific and the more realistic type of thing, the other ones would be looking for more sensational things to put out. And The Mummy's Curse was a perfect example of that. Yeah? So, an example, right? Because, for example, there was an innocuous text inscribed on mud plaster before the Anubis shrine in the treasury. And what it actually said, or translated to be said, was, "I am the one who prevents the sand from blocking the secret chamber." Right? Quite logical. And might have been a warning in the sense of, if you knock me down, the sand will block the secret chamber. So don't knock me down, because otherwise you won't be able to find the secret chamber, right? Well, when the newspapers reported it, it became metamorphosized into, "I will kill all of those who cross the threshold into the sacred precincts of the royal king who lives forever." Nothing like what it actually said. And that was the kind of garbage that the press were doing. Thank goodness they don't do that anymore, like fake news and stuff like that, right? Yeah, right. Okay. So, of course, this was part of the thing, and The Mummy's Curse became bigger and bigger and bigger. Whether it was true or not, who knows? I think Carter died as well. Oh, actually, I'm not sure he did. I think he might have lived for a long time, and so did Lady Evelyn. But Lord Carnarvon died. But there have been other examples of the idea of a curse. And I think Lord Carnarvon, they said he died from a sting of an asp. A bite of an asp, like a snake, same as Cleopatra died, right? But in fact, they think he died of an infection. He had a mosquito bite, and he shaved, and he cut himself, and he got an infection in it. And of course, in those days, infections were deadly. And that's what he died from. An infected mosquito sting. There we are. Okay, so mummies, like with their powers, they also had weaknesses. And again, they vary between different mediums, right? Some examples state that mummies are brought to life by magic spells or curses upon their tombs. For example, if a treasure was stolen from a mummy's tomb, then the mummy may be put to rest only after it has retrieved its treasure and or has punished the thief. Other more conventional weaknesses of mummies include vulnerability to fire or cold. So you could set a mummy on fire because they're dry and covered in bandages. Right. And in fact, we've probably seen that in the movies, I suspect. So at the beginning, we talked of the word revenant. And again, that is used over and over for different purposes, especially now in fantasy games. But according to Wiki, the revenant has been used interchangeably with vampire or ghost by folklorists. Now, some maintain that vampires derive Eastern European folklore, and revenants are a similar thing that derive from Western European folklore. But most people say, hey, revenant's just a generic term for the undead. Got it. Now, of course, one of the undead could be just a plain old skeleton. And this is according to Wiki, right? And a skeleton is a type of physically manifested undead, but it's often found in fantasy, gothic, and horror fiction. Back in the day, I can't remember what movie it was, but it was one of the Greek ones that said whether the dragon's teeth were sown, it was part of, I don't know, Perseus or Theseus or one of those, Jason and the Argonauts, something. I think it might have been Jason and the Argonauts, actually. And the king sows the dragon's teeth, and then that produces the skeleton soldiers. Now, most of them are human skeletons, but they can also be from any creature or race found on Earth or in the fantasy world. The problem I've always had with a human skeleton-type monster is it's got no muscles to move. So how does it move? Well, I guess it's magic, isn't it? Now, animated human skeletons have been used as a personification in death in Western culture since the Middle Ages. And this personification was perhaps influenced by the Valley of the Dry Bones in the Book of Ezekiel. So there may be that historical connection as far as the Bible's concerned. And in art, too, this is the case, because the Grim Reaper is often depicted as a hooded skeleton holding a scythe, as we explained, a stick with a curved blade on the top, and occasionally an hourglass, which has been attributed to Hans Holbein, the younger, famous painter, in 1538. And death, as one of the biblical horsemen of the apocalypse, has been depicted as a skeleton riding a horse. The Triumph of Death is a 1562 painting by Peter Bruegel, the Elder, depicting an army of skeletons raiding a town and slaughtering its occupants. And this is very influential. A lot of the sort of medieval Renaissance artists were commissioned to paint religious type paintings so they could do, they could be masters of their art of painting and so on and so forth. But as long as they picked a religious target, somebody would pay them for that. So that was a good thing to do. And they didn't run foul of religious rules and the Inquisition and stuff like this, because, hey, I'm just painting, you know, here's the four horsemen of the apocalypse as mentioned in the Bible. And this is how you end up with this idea, because there's that famous one of the Last Supper. This is how you get the idea that Jesus and the apostles were all white men, don't you? Yeah, and one of them was a woman. But anyway, that's the way that is. And that leaves the impression, of course, that then follows over from medieval times, where things were maybe kind of pushed along by the idea of magic and myth and legend and stuff like this into more modern times. Okay. But figures and images of skeletons are still around a lot, doing but they would be figured as doing routine things. And they're common in Mexico's Day of the Dead celebration, which is the Dia de los Muertos. Okay, the Day of the Dead. And skulls symbolize life, and their familiar circumstances invite levity. So it's the idea of just accepting that death is part of life, which of course it is. And so you'd get a skeleton digging the garden, get a skeleton riding a donkey, get a skeleton drinking at a bar. Don't know where that beer would go once you swallowed it, but there we are. Now, the modern association between skeleton iconography and the Day of the Dead was inspired by La Calavera Catrina, Katrina with a C, Katrina, which in fact was a zinc etching created by Mexican cartoonist José Guadalupe Posada in the 1910s and published posthumously in 1930. Now, he created it as a satire of Mexican women who were ashamed, for some reason, of their indigenous origins and dressed imitating the French style, wearing heavy makeup to make their skin look whiter, like a corpse, right? And it later became a more general symbol of vanity. But the idea was that, well, what happened was, is during the 20th century, the Katrina entrenched itself in the Mexican consciousness and became a national icon, often depicted in folk art. So that you'd have the Dia de los Muertos. It's interesting how it all ties together, because you have the pagan Samhain, which was on the, I think, the 31st of October and the 1st of November, right? In this case, in the sort of Christian side of things, you'd have Halloween, so that's the evening of All Hallows Day, which would be the first, which I think was All Saints Day, and then the next day, the second, was All Souls Day, where they would honor the dead, same sort of thing. In the Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead in Mexico, Skulls, usually made of sugar and candy and stuff like that, were given to children on November the 1st, when they celebrated the deaths of children, and the death of adults was celebrated on November the 2nd. So it's interesting how that carries across all ages. And I mean, the Celtic, the Samhain, of course, that was our roots, came from the Celtics, the Celts. And we, us British people, were Celts originally, before along came, you know, the Romans, the Angles, the Saxons, the whatever, Vikings, Norwegians, and so on, Germans, French, and so on. Okay, so that's Dia de los Muertos. Now let's talk about vampires. That's a good thing to talk about, isn't it? Yeah, let's do that now. Actually, that's a long section. That's all right. So, I did this in a show back in 2018, a vampire show. You can look it up on my website, www.doc28.com. And I did a show on vampires. And the origin, as far as I could tell, of a vampire came from the story of a young Italian man named Ambrogio and the love of his life, Selina. And she was a virgin maiden of the temple, and thus the property of Apollo, the sun god. And I still question this just obsession with virginity and celibacy in religion. It just seems odd to me. The most natural thing, otherwise we wouldn't be here, right? Why it's so important, the virgin or the celibacy or whatever. It's probably a lot to do with human beings and religion. But anyway, there we are. She was a virgin maiden of the temple and the property of Apollo, the sun god. Now, Ambrogio, and of course, she would have been more, there would have been many maidens of the temple, so it wasn't like she was the only one. That's important to know. Now, Ambrogio fell in love with Selina after visiting the legendary oracle in the temple, because that was the temple of Apollo, was where the oracle was based. He asked her to marry him. But Apollo wanted her for his own, probably not for his own, just wanted to keep her as a virgin maiden of his temple, because gods are fickle and egotistical. So he cursed Ambrogio by causing his skin to burn whenever it was exposed to sunlight. So score one property of a vampire, right? So Ambrogio didn't know what to do, so he turned to Hades, the god of the underworld. Well, you know this is going to get bad. And he made a deal at the cost of his soul. And then he went sneakily to Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, as if going for help. But he tried to steal her silver bow, because that was the deal he had made with Hades. And he failed in the theft from Artemis's bow, who was a goddess. So Artemis cursed Ambrogio so that silver would burn his skill. Check another property of a vampire, right? Now, Ambrogio killed 45 swans. Why he had to kill 45, I don't know. Seems a bit cruel to me, but anyway, I deviate. But he killed 45 swans to get quills and blood ink to communicate with Selina. I don't know why he couldn't kill one or two and kept the ink in a pot and pulled all the quills out. But never mind. Okay. So he got the ink to communicate with Selina, and he worshipped Artemis. And the gods and goddesses love being worshipped. I don't understand for the life of me why, but they do love being worshipped. So Artemis took pity on him and gave him super strength, immortality, and fangs. As long as he and Selina remained celibate. There it is again. What difference does it... No, never mind. Okay. The mortal Selina escaped Apollo's grasp and reunited with the immortal Ambrogio. But they never got it on, because that was part of the deal, right? Unfortunately, she was mortal, So she got older and he didn't, and eventually she became ill. Right? So, of course, he went to Artemis again, and she told him that he could make Selena immortal by drinking her blood to death, and then her spirit would live on. So he killed her, drank her blood, and her spirit ascended to become goddess of the moon, so she was immortal too. Now you've got their combined blood in Ambrosio, which meant that anyone who drank it turned into a vampire. And you've seen that on all the movies where Dracula gets his sharp fingernail and cuts a little bit of blood and the blood comes down and he puts the person's lips to it and then they're now going to become a vampire. Got it. Okay. So that's all the qualities of a vampire right there. Burned by the sun, burned by silver, immortal, drinks blood. Got it. Got fangs as well. Lovely job. Now, of course, we all think of a vampire as being Dracula. And there was a real guy, Dracula, in 1431. His name was Vlad Dracula. He was born in Transylvania, which is perfect for the old Hammer horror movies, right? And that's in Romania. And he ruled Wallachia, Romania, off and on from about 1456 to 1462. And he gained the name Dracul from his father's membership of the Order of the Dragon, because dragon is Dracul in Romania. So that's how you get Dracula. And he hated the Ottoman Empire because the Ottoman Empire was always trying to take over Transylvania and being brutal to him. And they imprisoned him twice. So some historians describe him as a just but yet brutally cruel ruler, and he used every dirty and cruel trick to fight off the Ottoman Empire because they were huge and Transylvania was small. So he did that by subjecting his prisoners, presumably Turkish Ottoman prisoners, excuse me, to torture, mutilation, disemboweling, beheading, skinning, or boiling alive. Very nice, very nice. He also killed his enemies by impaling them on a wooden stake, and that got him the name as Vlad the Impaler. Now, legend has it that Vlad Dracula enjoyed dining amidst his dying victims and dipping his bread in their blood. That's pretty horrid, isn't it? But at least it was fresh. Now, here's a thing that's kind of funny. In fact, I'll come back after this.
Have you ever asked yourself why? Well, now you can ask Andy why. News, views and conspiracy theories.
And this is Beatroot Radio, community radio for Rushton and Valley. And we have been talking about vampires just now. And there's a little bit of advice for any kind of wannabe vampire hunters out there. If you're going to kill a vampire, start at dawn, not dusk. Because the amount of movies I've seen where you see the vampire hunters and they seem to have problems on their route and everything, and they get there just as the sun's going down. The carriage is racing through the forest and you could see the sun going down in the distance. And to me, it's like, oh no, the sun's going down, we'll come back tomorrow. No, 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 no. They've got to get there for that night. They've got to get there for that reason. And they usually do it. And it's like, oh, you know what's going to happen. They're going to kill a few of the sub-vampires. And then eventually the sun's going to go down. And then suddenly the big vampire's up and about and causing havoc. And it's like, no, no, no. You just look at the, go to Google, look at the time, it's going to get light in the morning, get yourself all ready. Soon as it's light, in you go, into the caves, up to the castle, whatever it is like this, that's the time to be killing vampires. Don't do it at sort of 5 to 6, 5 to twilight or whatever it is like this. Just don't do it, all right? And there you have it. Okay, there's another one called a wight. A wight, yes. And this is a creature or a living sentient being. In its original usage, the white is described as a living human being, especially one who was valiant and brave. Isn't that weird? But it's come to be used within fantasy to describe certain undead. And I mention this because it's become quite popular. So, whereas you had this creature that was valiant, a person who was valiant and brave, somehow this has got twisted around to be some evil creature. And the earliest example of the uses in English is in William Morris's translation of the Grettis saga, wherein Hagbui is translated as barrow white. So that would be a white that inhabits a barrow, which is a grave. As we know, we got barrows all the way around. Certainly England. In fact, Britain, I think. Whites, of course, also figure in J.R.R. Tolkien's World of Middle-earth, especially in The Lord of the Rings, but also in George R.R. Martin's HBO television series of Game of Thrones. Yes, something I have never watched. And novel series A Song of Fire and Ice. Now, since its 1974 inclusion in the role-playing games Dungeons and Dragons, it has become a recurring form of the undead in other fantasy games and mods. But really, I don't think there's any basis that this was a undead creature of legend and legend and mythology. In fact, it's been made that way by fantasy. And there you go. Now, before we talk about this little bit I've got on zombies here, let's talk about some other little thing just quickly, because the boss mentioned it to me on my way in, and I thought it was rather interesting. He said, "Oh, yeah, isn't it that zombie drug?" And I'm like, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, and I've kind of heard of it," but he had more details. But anyway, this zombie drug I'm looking at on my phone right now is called Crocodil. And it's what has been termed by the press a flesh-eating zombie drug causing a global crisis. And it's known as desomorphine. And it's been in the news because its street name is Crocodil. However you know it, it's a cheap substitute for heroin. And it's been widely branded as a flesh-eating zombie drug. And there are two reasons for its horrific reputation. One is related to the desomorphine itself, the second to the way it's produced. It goes through the chemical ideas and so on, how it's produced from morphine. Actually, I think it's produced from codeine. It was originally synthesized to create a painkiller with a fewer side effects than morphine. But it did offer greater analgesic power, in other words, painkilling power, but it really had a problem causing dependence, that is, addiction, right? So desomorphine was largely forgotten, but then it brought back into prominence, and the Russian government restricted the movement of heroin from Afghanistan into Russia around 2003, so there was a sharp increase in the price of heroin on the street. And as a consequence, Russian addicts started looking for cheaper substitutes, including desomorphine. Right. Now, the base, and of course, it can be made in kitchen laboratories. The base ingredient is codeine, which is another natural painkiller found in poppies, opium poppies. And it's mixed with a bunch of things to make it into Crocodil. How did it get the name Crocodil? Well, one theory is that it refers to the scaly green skin it can create around injection sites. That's disgusting and horrible, isn't it? What a shame for these people. What a shame. Okay, so it became prevalent in Russia, then it led to a lethal epidemic there. It has now spread to Colombia, the US, and then, of course, Europe, including the UK. It's very cheap. Because there's codeine is quite available, you can make it at home, basically. And it typically includes ingredients like paint thinner, hydrochloric acid, iodine, phosphorus from matchboxes, stuff like that, garbage like that. Okay, so that is crocodile. Now, what happens is, of course, is users inject their impure desamorphine, and if they miss the vein, they may end up with an abscess or dead flesh. Other health effects include gangrene, phlebitis, bone infection, pneumonia, not to mention brain damage. There's needle sharing, which can spread HIV and hepatitis C. Generally, addicts often die within 2 to 3 years. So it really is a mess. And because the high they get from crocodile is actually quite short, addicts end up in a cycle of making it, taking it, making it, taking it, making it, taking it. They don't eat food. They don't make money. They don't do anything except make it, take it, make it, take it, make it, take it until they die. It's very sad. Very sad indeed. And it's a popular drug of abuse. Very sad. There you go. That's crocodile. So it's not really a zombie drug. It doesn't really turn them into zombies. But it has that kind of effect, and that's how it's got that reputation. There you go. There you go. All right, so let's talk about the zombies in this little bit I'm going to do now. Now, it's quite interesting, because does anyone trust the governments? Left a little bit of silence there. This one's the US government, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the sub-department, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, right? And what they did was they came up with this great idea of how can we make people learn about emergency procedures, precautions they should take, stuff like this, because people just don't read this stuff. And then someone must have come up with a bright idea and said, well, let's include one of the emergency procedures. Let's make it a zombie apocalypse. And so they've actually written this, and I'm going to read a whole bunch of this stuff out to you and try and get that in before the end of the show. The point is, though, because we don't trust these people, you've got to wonder, as you're going through this, right, are they doing this to cover their butt in case something goes wrong? We've seen this drug crocodile that came out, and we know this stuff was manufactured back in 1922 and was found to be too dangerous because of addiction. And we know that groups like DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration, whatever they are, they're the people who invented the internet, I think. They're always experimenting with stuff and trying to look for how do we build a super soldier? How do we make our soldiers invulnerable to nerve agents and stuff like this? Maybe they might do something like this and it might escape somehow. All right. Now, these are quotes now. So this is a quote. We've all seen at least one movie about flesh-eating zombies taking over. My personal favorite is Resident Evil. And I'll just note there, it doesn't say who this person who wrote this is, so why would we care what your personal favourite is? You're the government. But anyway, it goes on. Where do zombies come from and why do they love eating brains so much? The word zombie comes from the Haitian and New Orleans voodoo origins. Although its meaning has changed slightly over the years, it refers to a human corpse mysteriously reanimated to serve the undead. Through ancient voodoo and folklore traditions, shows like The Walking Dead were born. It goes on. In movies, shows, and literature, zombies are often depicted as being created by an infectious virus, which is passed on via bites and contact with bodily fluids. Harvard psychiatrist Stephen Schlossman wrote a fictional medical paper, and that's in inverted air quotes, right? Fictional medical paper on the zombies presented in The Night of the Living Dead and refers to the condition as ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome caused by an infectious agent. Ataxic means it affects your nervous system so you are not coordinated. You move like a zombie, basically. You can't go fast because your nerves are affected. Neurodegenerative is a breakdown of the nervous system, which would add to that. Satiety is, of course, to do with hunger, the hunger for brains, deficiency syndrome. So you get that. Ataxic, neurodegenerative, satiety, deficiency syndrome. Now, the Zombie Survival Guide, which is what we're talking about here from the CDC, still quoting, the Zombie Survival Guide identifies the cause of zombies as a virus called solanum. Now, solanum is a potato tree. It's a plant that people often grow. It's called a potato tree because it does have these little potato-like fruits that grow that are toxic and poisonous. And again, remember back what I said about not trusting governments. What could be going on here? Who knows, right? Back to the quotes. Other zombie origins shown in films include radiation from a destroyed NASA Venus probe, as in Night of the Living Dead, as well as mutations of existing conditions such as prions, folded proteins. Now, what is that? Well, this is this. They've managed to fold proteins in looking for biological warfare, basically. Perhaps that's got out. Mad cow disease, measles, rabies, stuff like that. But those prions, folded proteins, they produce some scary diseases. Back to the quotes. The rise of zombies in pop culture has given credence to the idea that a zombie apocalypse could happen. In such a scenario, zombies could take over entire countries, roaming city streets, eating anything that got in their way. Reminder, this is a quote from the US Government Department of Health and Human Services Center for Disease Control. And then they start coming in with some other things. The proliferation of the zombie idea has led many people to wonder, how do I prepare for a zombie apocalypse? Well, we're here to answer that question for you and hopefully share a few tips about preparing for real emergencies too. How would you hide the obvious in plain sight, right? So what do you need to do before zombies or hurricanes or pandemics, for example, actually happen? First of all, you should have an emergency kit in your house that includes things like water, food and other supplies to get you through the first couple of days before you can locate a zombie-free refugee camp, or in the event of a natural disaster, it will buy you some time until you are able to make your way to an evacuation center, shelter, or utility lines are restored. You will need water, food, medications, tools and supplies, sanitation and hygiene, clothing and bedding, important documents, copies of your driver's license, passport and birth certificate, to name a few. And my comment, because of course the government still needs to keep track of you. First aid supplies, although you're going to be a goner if a zombie bites you. The one thing it doesn't say in there, which we'd all be surprised about, it doesn't mention guns. And you know very well that some prepper survivor in the United States, the first thing they're going to do is pack a pump action shotgun and 1,000 shells, because that's how you kill zombies, right? So there's going to be guns all over the place, and people are going to be shooting the heck out of each other because they might think that their next door neighbor's a zombie, and just the fact that he's drunk half a bottle of Jack Daniels, right? What a mess it would be. But anyway, going back to the quotes from the government, US government. Once you've made your emergency kit, you should sit down with your family and come up with an emergency plan. This includes where you should go and who you would call if zombies started appearing outside your doorstep. You should pick 2 mating places, one close to your home and one farther away. Identify the types of emergencies that are possible in your area. Besides a zombie apocalypse, this may include floods, tornadoes, or earthquakes. Pick a meeting place for your family to regroup in case zombies invade your home, or your town evacuates because of a hurricane. Pick one place right outside your home for sudden emergencies, and one place in and one place outside of your neighbourhood in case you are unable to return home right away. Identify your emergency contacts. Make a list of local contacts like the police, fire department, and your local zombie response team. Also identify an out-of-state contact that you can call during an emergency. Plan your evacuation route. When zombies are hungry, they don't stop until they get food, i.e. brains, which means you need to get out of town fast. Plan where you would go and multiple routes you would take ahead of time so that the flesh eaters don't have a chance. This is also helpful when natural disasters strike and you have to take shelter fast. And then the statement that I think is the scariest of all. Never fear, CDC is ready. Oh my goodness, that's pretty scary, ain't it? That doesn't make me feel confident at all. But there we go. Anyway, never fear, the CDC is here. So what are they going to do? How are they going to resolve this issue? The zombies running around in the street or other things? Okay, back to the quotes. If zombies did start roaming the streets, CDC would conduct an investigation, much like any other disease outbreak. The CDC would provide technical assistance to cities, states, or international partners dealing with a zombie infestation. Now, wait a minute. You're going to do an investigation. You're going to provide technical assistance. There's zombies running around the streets eating people's brains. This is incredibly infectious disease. And you're just going to do an This assistance, back to the quotes. This assistance might include consultation, lab testing and analysis, patient management and care, tracking of contacts, and infection control, including isolation and quarantine. You really think in the United States of America they're going to quarantine zombies? Really? Well, okay, they might keep one or two to see if they can cure them. What do you think's going to happen to the rest? Just a thought. So it's likely an investigation of this scenario would seek to accomplish several goals. Okay, here we go now. This is going to fix the problem. Determine the cause of the illness. Determine the source of the infection virus toxin. Well, it was DARPA. It was the CDC, whatever. Learn how it is transmitted and how readily it is spread. How to break the cycle of transmission. We run out of brains, and thus prevent further cases, and how patients can best be treated. Not only would scientists be working to identify the cures and cure of the zombie outbreak, but CDC and other federal agencies would send medical teams and first responders to help those in affected areas. Now, how do you help somebody who's become a zombie? I don't think you can you? What you generally do is blow their head off, or chop it off, or hit it with a cricket bat, depending what movie you listen to, right? What you watch, right? Of course, the one thing the CDC has stopped to mention is, of course, the National Guard and the military would be activated. And they're all armed with guns, howitzers, machine guns, grenades, and they'd be using them, of course. Pretty indiscriminately, I would think, if we go by the plots of various movies where there's all these zombies running around, they'd just be opening fire on everything. Lots of innocent people, people who are hiding, stuff like this, would get killed also. This is the CDC. Remind yourself, never fear. The CDC is ready. That's more scary than anything, isn't it? The fact that they have this hubris that they think they could cope with something like that. Because you've seen it, haven't you? The zombies take over the whole country. And you end up with this little group of survivors that gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And Danny gets his leg caught under the truck and can't get away. And the zombies get him. But the dog manages to survive. And the pregnant woman survives. And the hero survives. And the kid survives. But all the rest, sorry mate, they've gone. Don't worry, I'll hold them off until you get away. All this beautiful stuff like this, it makes a great movie, right? And eventually they end up on a boat heading off towards some island where they hope there aren't any zombies. That's a beauty. That's a good way of doing it, right? Because I'm not sure zombies can swim. Actually, they probably can't because of the coordination problem. The ataxic part of that syndrome. So they probably all drown. Well, would they drown? Do they breathe? Because they're already dead. They could walk along the bottom of the ocean, I suppose. Maybe the fish would eat them. Anyway, just speculating here, right? But not to worry. Never fear. The CDC is ready. And there we go. So, never fear, the CDC is ready. Well, what about the British? What have we got? And I did a quick bit of, very quick bit of research, and I looked on the Public Health England site. Now, they don't actually have anything about zombies, which is a bit disappointing, because it might tell you how to swing a cricket bat correctly to break somebody's head or, you know, whatever, one of those sort of things. But I did find the investigations into infectious diseases, which I guess is what this is, especially serious infectious diseases, on the Public Health England site. And basically what it said is, oh yeah, this stuffy old process that you have to go through, and you have to select committees, and you have to get the right people in place and define who's in charge and all this kind of thing. If you've ever been looked at these things, you'll see that's the way the British do things. And the main thing is they'll start the official investigation within 24 hours. Well, imagine if a zombie outbreak took place in London with all those people there. How many millions of them would be infected after 24 hours? And then they put together an outbreak control team, and according to their website, it says that's got to be done within 3 days. Well, within 3 days, people would be getting on the boats and leaving the country and hoping they'll do better in France or Ireland or somewhere like that, right? And of course, the Irish wouldn't be letting us get off the boats. They'd be saying, you're not in the EU, you're not coming over here. No, they wouldn't. They'd be saying, you might be infected with a virus. So you push your boat away, all this, or we'll sink you. Okay? But the main thing is, once the outbreak control team have set up after 3 days, got to be done within 3 days, not to worry, they'll carry out daily and weekly phone calls to keep in touch. Seriously? And there you go. That's my show. I thought you'd enjoy that bit about the zombies and everything. And there we are. Next week, the best of British banking at the same time, 8 p.m. And there you go. It just remains for me. It's my privilege to be here, of course, presenting you with this information. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to do so. And I wish you a great rest of the weekend, of course. And as always, as I always say, please take care.